This is a lecture on a passage from Herbert Marcuse's small book, A Study on Authority, with some reference, small reference, towards the end to Immanuel Kant's What is Enlightenment? Herbert Marcuse was 20th century, 1960s, I guess 1950s to 1970s, Frankfurt School German political philosopher. In our course, it might be important to think about the fact that he was maybe the favorite teacher of Angela Davis. He taught not only in Germany, but then later here in San Diego at UCSD, where he became the object of a scandal driven by the FBI and the KKK. This is around the same time that Angela Davis was pushed out of UCLA. Marcuse, like the rest of the Frankfurt School, for example, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, Jürgen Habermas, and to some degree, Hannah Arendt and Walter Benjamin, was involved in updating Marxist theory in conjunction with Nietzschean theory, Freudian and post-Freudian psychoanalytic theory, and Max Weber's sociology as a tool for understanding post-World War II Western media-dominated societies. Marcuse was arguably the most influential of the Frankfurt School thinkers, at least on a practical level. Adorno and Habermas have been central for theoretical traditions, but maybe they were less practically political themselves. Through people like Davis, Marcuse influenced liberation movements in the 1960s and 1970s. At least early on, Angela Davis understood her own practice in Marcusean terms. And he was also very influential for hippies and the New Left, particularly in his condemnation of a sexually repressive society, which he thought operated to reroute energies from pleasure and thought towards labor, even in a situation where automation could take over most work. The main book to check out there is Marcuse's Eros and Civilization. That's, I think, a late 1950s text. Now, here's a side note. One thing worth noting in this course is that while I am pointing out relatively distinct traditions, and that's how I organized the course, here a Marxist one, and with Davis, a kind of late 20th century little cross-section of the black radical tradition, in fact, these traditions are related. Later, when we read Robin Kelly, he'll explain how black thought has been involved both with surrealism and with Marxism. It is not reducible to those European intellectual trends, but it's not totally separable either. Davis' incorporation of Marxist and Hegelian forms of thought from Marcuse is one example of this cross-pollination. So that's a word of warning to those anti-colonial students, with whom I'm very sympathetic, who want to throw out whatever is written by white folks and want to accept only those things written by people of color. The warning is the European tradition persists within writers of color as well. This is probably to some degree inescapable, given the destruction of indigenous traditions and the erasure of African thought carried out by colonialism itself. You know, historically, black and indigenous thinkers have made use of European critical traditions because they have had a need to understand the systems that dominate and genocide them. We have this need too. And this critical analysis, to some extent, does exist within the Western colonial tradition because that tradition itself is internally contradictory, because that society is premised on the subjugation of workers and women and racialized populations. That tradition is a synthesis, therefore, both of dominating and of revolutionary tendencies, like Marxism. This is not to say that Marxism does everything that black and indigenous people and women need. It doesn't. It has grave shortcomings, which even thinkers like Fanon were sometimes blind to. But the point here is simply that some European thought has been central to anti-colonial thinkers. Marx for Mariátegui in Peru, Marx for C.L.R. James, Hegel and existentialism for Fanon, Marcuse for Davis. Anyway, back to Marcuse. Here in his Study on Authority, Marcuse traces what Nietzsche or Foucault would call a genealogy of ideology, focused on the Western notion of freedom. Genealogy here refers to the tracing of a concept historically trying to understand how the notion originated, how it operated in different social historical constellations, how its meaning changed or didn't, but most importantly, how the concept related and still relates to dominant practices, and especially how it reinforces a certain social and property order. And then in closing, I'll make reference to Immanuel Kant. He was a German philosopher, end of the 1700s, occupying a key junction in the Western philosophical tradition. For one thing, he's the point where analytic and continental philosophical traditions diverge. Anglo-American philosophers and French and German philosophers agree that Kant is good philosophy, but the next significant step out of Kant, Hegel, is accepted as a key philosopher only in the continental tradition. Anyway, for Marcuse's purposes, here Kant matters because he reiterates the bourgeois model of freedom that Marcuse says originates in Christian theory in a secular format. Kant puts it into a secular format. I'd say specifically in What is Enlightenment, Kant also justifies academia. And if we want to be critical, as Marcuse does, Kant shows what is problematic about it. Or rather, Marcuse shows what's problematic about Kant. The problem is that academia speaks and thinks freely, but that it allows its free thought will in no way impede its obedience to state and capitalist forms of life in the material domain. Okay, so here's Marcuse's idea, the Western notion of individual freedom. He's trying to show us that this notion has a history. Marcuse discusses bourgeois freedom, meaning the notion of freedom that is dominant within Western, Northern capitalist societies, societies in which, from the Protestant Reformation onward, the bourgeois or capitalist class, the group of individuals controlling significant money used for investment and profit returns, ascended to power. The focus of the portion I gave you is the interval from the Protestant Reformation with Luther and Calvin, that's the 1500s in Europe, till roughly the American and French revolutions, 1776, 1789. Marcuse also mentions Kant, and his next chapter, which I did not assign, covers Kant, who wrote What is Enlightenment in 1784, just before the French Revolution. Marcuse's contention is that the linked notions of freedom and of the autonomous subject, now autonomy is a key word for this course. Auto means self, nomos means law-giving, so autonomy means giving yourself the law or being self-determining, being the one who determines the rule that you yourself will follow. That's autonomy. These notions of freedom and the autonomous subject, the free individual, which are dominant in Western society and then imposed colonially as an ideology over the majority of the planet via conquest, missions, and especially colonial education, this notion has its origins in Christianity. Really, the whole genealogy that he's giving us here extends at least from Paul, who is arguably the organizer, I want to say the founder, of Christianity as a state religion, as a large-scale and orthodox religion. He's the one who writes much of the New Testament. And I would argue, really, this genealogy could be followed back to Plato, which is 400, 450 BCE. The genealogy goes from that ancient period through the Middle Ages, through the Protestant Reformation, through the Enlightenment, and up through the 18th and 19th centuries to the present. And the claim, basically, is that a Christian notion of freedom gets refined by Protestantism and synthesized with capitalism. Here, Marcuse is drawing very heavily on Max Weber in emphasizing the ways that Protestant tenets like the work ethic, respect for property and authority, the notion of our jobs being a calling or a vocation given us by God, or at least that we should find this job, which is our calling, that these things merged in Northern Europe with capitalist economic practices. Now, those practices had existed elsewhere on multiple occasions. Like, the Roman world had capitalists, but the Roman world, though imperial, did not become a full capitalist society. It's when the Christian ethic merges with capitalist practices in Northern Europe in the 1400s and 1500s. They produce a specific form of life, which then facilitates the spread of capitalism on an unprecedented scale. So the book here that discusses this is Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. So these Protestant notions of freedom become normative across Europe, and then they are spread globally via European colonization. And that's why they matter to us. Though we want to be critical of the European tradition, we are in it. And we're in it against our wills. And I'm a white dude talking. I'm here because of that colonial movement. And some of you who don't identify as white people, some of you who are not white people, might want to think even more about how you are in with this European tradition, though you certainly did not choose it, and who you and your people are and the languages that you speak and the values that you have and the notions of freedom and subjectivity that you have are a part of this colonial expansion. And these notions are still operative today. When people assert that the external world cannot touch them, because their freedom is within, they are repeating a formulation with a long history, and for very old reasons. Namely, that when people understand their freedom in this way, they leave the social order that captures and exploits them alone. That's the basic function of this notion. It allows people to say, and perhaps even feel, that they are free, but it keeps them from freeing themselves on a material level. Marcuse's genealogy is also a critique of this bourgeois freedom, as he says that it essentially includes its opposite, unfreedom, within itself. This particular autonomy, which is purely internal or spiritual, corresponding to the soul, also affirms a heteronomy, hetero, other, nomos, law-giving. So heteronomy means determination from without. That's the bad guy in our picture. Or the problem we want to talk about. At the same time that we understand ourselves as internally free following this bourgeois model, there is also implied an external, material, bodily level where we are determined from without. And let me repeat, it is not just the notion of freedom with which we are dealing here, it's the very Western notion of the self. This autonomous self, the free subject, which is codified in Christian doctrine as responsible for its own sin and salvation, and in the legal sphere as the citizen who is responsible before the law, is itself an aspect of the domination of the subject in the state capitalist order. In fact, on the Marxist understanding from which Marcuse is coming, all ideology is itself an aspect of the domination of the subject. And this includes even the subjects we believe and perhaps even feel that we are. Who we think we are is a part of a dominant system of ideas which is imposed upon us by forces outside of us. At the same time that Luther and Calvin, the founders of Protestantism, affirm the basic freedom of the individual, they also affirm the total subjugation of individuals in a structure of rule and exploitation. First as peasants under lords and kings, and then as proletariat under capitalist owners. Internally, says this doctrine, you are totally free, but externally, you must act exactly as is demanded by your office, your position within society. Thus, women must obey men, children must obey parents, servants must obey their masters, slaves, their owners, bureaucrats, their kings, and the king, oh, no one. Because God has ordained it that there be order on earth, and who are we little people to question? It's notable that in Luther and Calvin, just as much as in the atheist Hobbes, a little bit later, rebellion against earthly authority is the greatest sin. European thinkers, religious and secular, agree. Without order, everything will be chaos and murder and bloodshed. Now, pause there, you know, as if these orders of rule are not responsible for massive bloodshed via warfare and massive suffering through radically unequal distribution of resources and so on. Now, this idea that we have to have order or else it'll all be chaos, a lot of us agree with this too. Like it or not, we say, you have to obey the law and do what your boss and the teacher say. Otherwise, there will be chaos, and we can't have that. But we need to understand that that's not necessarily, and I would say not even actually, true. And here's the purpose of critical genealogy. We need to understand there are historical and colonial reasons we think and say as we do. Though we are told we are free, the ideas that dominate us, even our ideas about ourselves and who we are, they come from outside and they capture us. They're not the products of our free minds. They're the products of history. They're parts of a machine that orders society for the benefit of a certain class, namely, in capitalist society, the owners. So here's Marcuse's basic analysis. Christian, this includes Catholic understandings, but especially Protestant freedom and subjectivity, which becomes the basic understanding of bourgeois individuality, the notion of the free individual with which we are very familiar. This rests upon a fundamental dualism. At the roughest level, this is the sort of dualism that characterizes Western thought through its whole course. On the one hand, there is the spiritual, the mental, the soul, and on the other hand, the material, the objective, the body. Even today, our being totally free is not a statement about our social order, not really, but rests on a fundamentally abstract codification of ourselves as being an internal phenomenon, as distinguished from an external order in which we are subject not only to law and police, but to economic necessity. We have to work. We have to take whatever we're going to get, whatever they're going to pay us at our jobs. We are subject to the fluctuations of markets, subject to property relations. You know, if you don't own, you're going to have to rent. You don't get to choose on that these points in any domain or almost any domain of the broad material and workaday world. We don't get to choose. We're not free there. The form of our life is determined from without, and yet we repeat. And we believe that somehow, in principle, we are free. That understanding comes out of this history. And that freedom refers to some idea of an internal soul that is separate from this external order. So how can we say we're free when all these external things so clearly determine the course and content of our lives? We can't go anywhere or even eat without money, which many of us can't get sufficiently, when whole cities end up unemployed because production was pushed offshore, when you've got to pay the rent you've got to pay because the market and the landlord say so. We can only opine that we are free, even in these conditions, because we are understood as something distinct from the world. Western logic separates each of us into two dimensions. One of them is supposedly the real us, but it's invisible to everyone except us and God, supposedly. The other self, our body that goes out and has a job, the one that shows up in our classroom, the other one is supposedly accidental or secondary, but really, it's all that can be seen. Everything that happens to our bodies and our families in the material world. Our freedom is internal. Externally, we are subjugated. So from Marcuse's perspective, bourgeois freedom is thus an elaborate falsification arising out of a long-lived Western dualism. The Western bourgeois notion of freedom thus bundles freedom and unfreedom together. We are internally free, but ultimately that freedom does not and cannot bear upon the world or our material condition. If it does, it is only insofar as we are free to obey. In fact, we are expected freely to accept legal and police and economic control. You're a good citizen if you show respect to these authorities. You voluntarily allow them to direct you. You experience yourself as free insofar as you freely submit. That's a little bit perverse. That may be the extent, however, of our worldly freedom. All the rest of it is otherworldly, internal, and thus at least potentially fictitious. And this bundled freedom slash unfreedom depends upon another typically Western state capitalist maneuver, the separation of the doer, me, you, who we really are from the deed, what we do at work, what we do as ICE agents, how we live as beneficiaries of neocolonialism. I can still be a perfectly moral person while I work at Northrop Grumman making bombs that are dropped on small children in Yemen because my true self is not in my acts. I and my acts are separate. Marx called this alienation. It's a core notion in this course. The capitalist world, according to Marx, rests upon a network of alienations, including centrally the separation of ourselves and what we do. One key point of this course is that revolutionary, liberatory traditions refuse to accept this separation of self and action as freedom, preferring to find freedom in an integral connection between who we are, what we think, and how we act. Nevertheless, the notion that good people still are just doing their jobs, whatever their jobs are, and so on, that notion is dominant in our society, in our schools, and in our media. Now, Kant's addition here. I'm reading What is Enlightenment, thinking about our context, our situatedness within academia. Kant is talking about the intellectual sphere in general, and specifically the sphere of publishing. But I'm going to focus on academia here. So I included Kant as a secondary source here. And wherever you see secondary sources, that means you don't have to read it. Making him secondary is a little unorthodox on my part, since Kant's What is Enlightenment is still fundamental, basic reading for political science students, right up through PhD students. Though it was written in 1784, it expresses a view that is still dominant today. Basically, it says that a free society, a society that is always progressing, and these are core Western notions that will be discussed further in Deloria and Kayser, is one where learned men, that's Kant's phrase, are free to think and publish whatever they want, even things that are critical of the existing order. They are free to do so, and enlightened authorities ought to hear them out, adopting their critical recommendations where they deem appropriate. At the same time, however, even these learned men are required to repeat religious dogma from the pulpit, state dogma in the classroom, and to obey exactly all laws and superiors. We have here again the separation of an intellectual domain of freedom and a material social domain of unfreedom. Again, in the background, the logic is that materially, we must have order or all will fall apart. So I would offer that the function of free thinking and critique, which exists only at the level of discourse, but may not compel any rebellious action remaining illegitimate, this now exists in our universities. We can deem ourselves a free society because we are free to say and think what we like, so long as we follow the law. And academics can believe themselves moral because they say what is right, they opine about how things ought to be, without doing anything about it, because that would be immoral. There is still, as in Luther and Calvin and Kant, an internal morality which knows very well that things like segregation or police shootings or economic inequality are unjust, but practically speaking, that is trumped by an external morality which requires we follow orders at work, at school, on the street, when those orders are given by anyone in an established position of authority over us. Here, the problem of alienation seems to be repeated. Thought, here on a large social scale, thought in the academy, is separated from action in the external world. And I bet a whole bunch of you, if you thought about this, you'd recognize, you know, thought in the academy is even separated from the people who study in the academy. A lot of the time, you don't know what, you know, professors and technical texts are saying. There's all kinds of separation, though we can understand that we are a free society because people can think and critique however they want. Often, the fact about that critique is that it is dangerous in no way to the existing order because it does not bear upon it and because it even voluntarily withdraws from the sphere of action. We academics can advise the existing authorities about what we think is good or bad, but it rests with the authorities to implement our suggestions or not. And our being good people includes our obeying them, even when we can see they are fools or worse. So still, the bourgeois notion of freedom includes a potentially fictitious and internal non-active freedom, but also an external subjugation. So one of the things that I hope you will consider throughout this course is how free or unfree we are in doing what we do in this course, in this school, in this city.